Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge this morning. Glad you could listen. During the first hour of the show, we'll talk about ideas for taking your career to a higher level of success or just doing better in the workplace. And our guest is Tom Schenck. He is a consultant, educator, and career coach with the Schenck Development Group in Champaign. He conducts a number of training programs for companies and agencies and so forth, and also does career coaching. And he joins us every once in a while to talk about how to do better in the workplace, whether you're just talking about doing a better job or being more successful as a professional. We're going to talk about some ideas, paradigms, concepts, whatever you want to call them, and maybe some sources for getting those ideas and actually making use of them effectively in the workplace. And we may talk about some books or training programs or basic concepts. The idea is to get at some really core ideas. And we certainly invite you to join us if you have a response to the things that we're talking about or ideas of your own, stories to tell about your own work life. Those will be welcome. All you have to do is call us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL also. Also, we have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us around the U.S. If you're listening on the Internet, you can use that phone number. We'll pay for the call. Or anywhere in the two-state region covered by our broadcast signal. That number is 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, anytime during this hour, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Tom Schenck, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Thanks for being back. I'm doing great.
It's good to be here. And congratulations to the station for doing such a bang-up job with the fund drive.
Well, congratulations to the audience for supporting us so well. The end of our fiscal year, of course, was June 30th. We don't have the final numbers, but we do know that we set another record in terms of listener support. So we thank everybody listening and everybody who contributes to the station in so many ways for supporting us this past year. And we'll certainly count on you in the future, too.
Well, that's good. I've been a long-time donor, so it's always good to see others joining in and helping out.
Great. Well, let's instead of doing a pledge break here, let's talk about the notion of success in the workplace and some ideas that people might be able to latch onto and make good use of. And I know we talked before we went on the air about certain key things that people are struggling with and that, you know, perhaps we could sort of dive in and talk about. One of those things is And from your experience recently, I guess, is particularly resonant these days in times of budget cutbacks and less people to do more work, setting priorities.
I had a very interesting experience just this week as I was thinking about the show and I was thinking about my clients. I was working with the university department, and they wanted to focus on building some of their leadership skills and some of their, I don't know, working together skills. They wanted to be more of a leadership team instead of a bunch of separate units inside of a department. And we worked on a whole variety of activities, and I asked them to make some plans and set some goals and do some other things, really create guidelines for how they work with each other and how they work with their employees. And they were able to do that great. They really did a wonderful job. The thing they found most challenging was setting priorities, mm-hmm. of actually deciding this is the first step, that's the second step, this is the third step, or deciding of these 10 ideas that we developed, these two are really the ones that we're going to hold ourselves completely accountable to. And that, I think, is true for most of us. Whether it's an organization, a team, or even individuals, prioritization is one of the toughest challenges because it makes us make choices. And making choices is really the big challenge for a lot of folks. But I think in the kind of wacky, weird economy that we're in right now, making choices is important. And the only way you can make effective choices that are good for you as well as the people you serve and the people you work with, it's by understanding what are your priorities. And priorities flow from values. Priorities flow from the things that are important to you. And when you can clearly articulate your priorities, then it's a lot easier to make better contributions, to do more, but not be stressed out, to work harder, but really work smarter in a way that leaves you feeling balanced in your life and able to do all the things that you're looking to do that are important to you.
Now, Tom, I know that the experience here isn't unique. A lot of places, people are feeling busier, they've got more to do because in many cases there are fewer, well, if the university is a good case, there's a hiring freeze basically. And so, you know, anytime anybody leaves, then, you know, the people who remain are left to take up that work. And, you know, it's a case where people are expected to do more and more, and in many cases with fewer resources and so forth. And so there's this incredible sense of busyness and, you know, I suppose a certain degree of stress. Under those circumstances, how do you begin to pick apart what you ought to do and sort of how do you go about setting priorities in circumstances that are that pressured?
I know very few organizations these days that have unlimited resources, growing budgets, and all that business. Most of us have to deal with, if nothing else, a steady budget, and most of us with reducing budgets. And I think that's true in personal lives just as much as on the job. So what you have to do is start by thinking about what's really important and get rid of that notion that you can have it all. You can't have it all. It's just that's a false notion that we've been sold over the last couple of decades. You can't have everything. You have to prioritize the things that are really important to you. So that's the first step, is just asking what's really important. I always like the 80-20 principle. Some people call it the Pareto principle. And it's the idea that 80% of the value comes from 20% of the activities that you're doing. If you have 10 items on your to-do list, two of them are much more important than the rest of them put together. Mm-hmm. And one of the big challenges is we don't go through that process of just asking the question, which are the two that are the most important here? And if you always focus on the two that are the most important, you're always going to get the important things done. You're going to feel less stressed. And as they always say, don't sweat the little things. You won't ever sweat the little things if you know which they are. So I think that's one of the very simple things that you can do to prioritize. Whenever you're confronted with a list of things you must do, whether those are year-long projects or whether those are things to do in the next hour, always just take a moment to ask yourself, of these X number of items, which are the couple that are really the most important? Mm-hmm. Keep that prioritization going. You'll always be more successful.
But if you take care of those things that you identify as the most important priorities, there might be things that don't get done.
Well, you have to, of course, always balance that. And I happen to use the 80-20 rule. You know, sometimes you have to go for the 70-30 split. Sometimes it's a 60-40 split. But the idea is you always identify those most important things. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the things that are important to you, but when you're in an organization, what's important to the organization? What's important to your boss? What's important to your teammates? What's important to your customers? And focus on those things primarily. If we don't, we end up doing the wrong things, and it doesn't satisfy the folks we're supposed to be satisfying, and then that's what causes you more stress.
There's another dynamic that happens in organizations where if something changes and you go about setting priorities and maybe do your work in a different way, which you might view and perhaps your supervisor or boss might also view as more effective and more important, but still there are forces within any organization that are used to things being done a certain way or certain things getting done at a certain time. And if you change the way you operate, it might upset some of those forces in the organization, because we all know that there's a sort of inertia in any human culture. And so, you know, people's ideas don't necessarily change just because you reset your priorities. So there might be conflict that comes from this.
Well, that's true. And in a team situation, for example, that's why you might have to work with your teammates to let them know why you're making certain changes and what those changes are. Of course, that's part of the prioritization process, is asking, how will my choices affect other people? And if you're making choices that are limiting somebody else's effectiveness, it's probably not a good choice. If you're making a choice that hurts other people's ability to get their job done, it may not be a good choice. So that will change how you prioritize that choice. So I think that we can always look at how our decisions and our actions affect other people. And that's true just as much at home as it's true on the job.
Also, isn't management involved in making some of those determinations and sort of negotiating the different roles as they shift?
Absolutely. And that might be as simple as when your boss hands you an assignment, the first thing you should ask your boss is, how does this assignment fit in with my other priorities that you've already given me? That one simple question can reduce a cartload of stress for people. And you can actually train your boss to let you know what their priority system is, so you can learn your boss's priority system just by asking that question. Over time, your boss will say, well, this is a priority, here's why. That's a priority, here's why. You'll start to get the rhythm of their priority system, and then you won't need to ask anymore. you'll be able to fit things in. And that's true whether your boss is a really cooperative, fun boss or whether your boss is a difficult boss who is not so cooperative. If you learn their priority system, you're always going to be more effective. And one of the activities that I always ask people, whether I'm talking to leaders or whether I'm talking to followers, is you should sit down and write out a list of what do you think are the five biggest priorities in your job? What do you think are the five biggest priorities this week or just today? And then take that list to your boss and see if they agree. And what we found is there's a lot of research out there. When I talk to folks about this, most people agree readily. The problem is we often don't have a connection between the boss and the employee. And so the employee thinks they're working on priorities that are the right priorities. The boss does not. And whether you have a contract, whether you have a job description, if you're not working on the things your boss thinks are important, you're not doing your job. And if you can just clarify with your boss what are the top priorities, then you're always going to be much more secure and safe in terms of that relationship, in terms of being seen by others who count as being important. If you're a leader, same thing applies. You need to go to your employees and ask them to write that list. What do you think are the top five priorities? Chances are there's going to be a little disconnect. And the closer we can bring those expectations and those priorities, the more harmony we're going to have in the workplace, the more productivity we're going to have, and the more likely it is that we'll actually be making good, positive contributions. Mm-hmm. It also is a tremendous way to reduce conflict, because unclear expectations, unclear priorities, conflicting priorities are some of the biggest sources of conflict in the workplace and the home as well.
Now, you've worked within the university community as well as in the business community and so forth. Especially, I think, in nonprofit organizations and higher educational institutions in general, there's a sense on the part of the staff and managers and professors and various other people who make up, in this case, the university, I guess, that we don't just serve our boss in our unit. We serve a larger constituency, whether it be the students or the public in the case of a service organization and so forth. And so there are multiple layers of sort of allegiances to constituencies and who you actually report to and sort of thereby how you set your priorities is dependent upon how you view those relationships. Have you run into situations where people are very conflicted about these different sort of relationships?
That falls under the category of, are you working in the right kind of an organization for you?
Yeah.
If the mission of your unit, of your department, of your entire organization is to serve some customer, whether that person is a student here at the university, or whether that person is another department, or whether that person is somebody who's walking in off the street and laying down $10 for a product or a service. Either way, if that's what the official mission is and your boss has some other goals, you might not be in the right job for you. That might be an environment you're not comfortable with. Conversely, that might mean that you need to clarify with your boss, wait a minute, if we're supposed to be serving the customer, whoever that is, why aren't we doing it? If that's not a high priority for your boss, then there's a disconnect at the boss level. And that might be a discussion that needs to happen. Usually, it's not so obvious as somebody simply deciding to be very selfish in their orientation or very self-oriented. Usually it's one of those things where perspectives just drift, so that we slowly stop serving customers, or over a period of time we change our attitude so we don't think of our customer as a customer. University is a great example. I don't know how many over the last 20 or so years that I've been on campus, both as a student employee, and as a consultant working with organizations within the university system, how many times I've heard something like the phrase, boy, my job would be great if it weren't for these blankety-blank students. You know, there's somebody who's lost sight about who they're really supposed to be serving. And that happens when we stop thinking of our primary customer as our primary customer. One of the little exercises we did this week in the university team I was working with, was I asked them to list out all of their customers. Mm-hmm. And they came up with about 20 different possible groups. Mm-hmm. People inside the university, people outside, people in their department, lots of people outside the department. And then I asked them the question, okay, prioritize them. Which are your top three? And they really were challenged with that. That was a tough, tough exercise for them. And most people don't think about it like that. Now, when I asked them to prioritize their customers, that wasn't saying that the ones that didn't make the top three were unimportant. We still need to serve those other ones too. But what we want to do is spend the lion's share of our time, energy, and effort in serving the primary customers. And that's a way to make sure that we're giving our most important customers the most important service, the best service that we can.
We're talking this morning with Tom Schenck of the Schenck Development Group here in Champaign about how to take your career to a higher level of success, talking about core ideas and concepts and stories and various other ways people have of understanding how to go about their work in a more effective way. If you have questions or comments, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. A lot of these conversations that you're suggesting people have with their bosses and various other people in the workplace involve a great deal of honesty and a feeling like they can communicate without fear. I remember a number of years ago, maybe it's not that long ago, seems like a long time ago, J. Arthur Deming was this management guru who, one of his doctrines was drive out fear, that fear was the enemy of effective organizations. But I sense that a lot of people still feel a great deal of fear in their organizations.
I think that's a fair statement. A lot of people do feel fear, but I'm afraid that a lot of times that's self-induced. That's based on assumptions that people make about what their organization is like, what their boss is like, what that coworker in the next cubicle is like. Mm-hmm. I don't know if everybody always bases that in reality. Mm-hmm. They base it on their impression. And I believe that really one of the other keys, if we're going to talk about fundamental principles, so prioritization is one. Mm-hmm. People skills and communicating with others, open communication with other people on the job is important. And this would fall into the category of give that boss, give your coworker the opportunity to do the right thing. And you'd be surprised. Many times they will. And it comes down to what kind of expectations we set and what kind of relationship we build through our communication with others. When we give people the opportunity to say, hey, this is what I think is a priority. What do you think? And you approach it as a problem-solving or even a team-building kind of approach, then some people respond very well. Are there going to be people who won't? Sure. Well, then that's the next stage. That's another conversation. But I think if we start off with the assumption that people will be cooperative, oftentimes they will be.
We have a couple callers to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. We'll go first to a listener on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Question for you. The example you just gave with the task of prioritizing your customers.
Right.
I work in an IT department where our main customers are the employees of the company. Really, we don't have contact with outside customers mainly. How would you go about prioritizing the top three departments in that aspect? Because how do I say, oh, the finance department is more important than the accounts payable department?
Excellent question, and there are a couple of ways that you can do that. One is simply look right now at how much effort, energy, and time your employees are putting in to each of those different customer groups inside your organization. And you can simply say, hey, whoever we're spending the most time with, they must be our most important customers. Are we serving them with the most resources that they deserve? So just looking at how much time you're already spending right now, and then I would take it to the next step and asking, is that appropriate? How would I make that decision? I would go ahead and take a look at, well, for your customer groups inside your own organization, what are their missions? Who are they supposed to be serving? Many people would make the argument that whichever departments have the first, most immediate contact with your external customers are the ones you should be serving first, because they're the ones who have the long-term impact in terms of customer satisfaction, your external customers who are presumably paying the bills. So that would be one way to take a look at it. Another way would be to go to the departments and ask them exactly what are the needs that you have right now. One organization that was also IT related that I was working with recently, what they found is one issue that was taking a lot of their time was simply password resets, people forgetting their passwords. Well, they realized that if they wanted to prioritize effectively and serve their customers in a way that their customers really wanted to be served, maybe they just needed to come up with a simple procedure for streamlining the password reset. And if they just did that, that would have tremendously improved how they use their time and serve their customers more quickly. So there, instead of looking at the department, what they were looking at, what are the common or frequent jobs that they're having to do for their customers, and prioritize that way. So instead of prioritizing customers, they're prioritizing the jobs that their customers are asking them to do for them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, fantastically.
Oh,
thank you so much.
Good. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the question. We have another caller on line number two in Monticello next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, how you guys doing today?
Great.
I'm a farmer over here, and my biggest frustration is when I go talk to somebody, you know, whether it's a university, you know, like extension or people I do business with, I don't think that they take me seriously as a farmer for the first of all, and then they just see me as an individual, and then they just say, well, you're just one person, and we don't really have to deal with just one person, and just sort of blow me off. How can I change that? I mean, it's really frustrating. You know, I've been dealing with, you know, people in extension for years and trying to, you know, bring about an idea about education for farmers, and everybody just looks at me and shakes their head, then slaps you on the back and helps you out the door. How can I, you know, change that?
Really interesting question. And I've had the opportunity over the years to work with several farmer groups, mostly in sustainable agriculture. And one of the things that I found is it's the old principle of banding together, strength in numbers. And a lot of the folks who are interested in sustainable agriculture, just as an example, they got together and formed statewide groups. And there's been a number of them that have kind of come in and out over the years. And the reason they did it was because they couldn't get the attention as individual farmers. So that would be one first suggestion, is find other people who, whatever your personal concerns are, your professional concerns, I should say, whatever those concerns are, find other farmers who are experiencing some of the same issues. And there's always the strength in numbers point of view. So that's one answer to that. The other thing, when it comes to credibility, which is really what you're talking about, I think one of the big keys to credibility is to be completely prepared in terms of facts. What exactly is the point you're trying to make? What's the documentation, or what kind of evidence, what kind of support can you offer to show why your point of view is important? And I guess now we have a lot of opportunity to do more research because we can connect with so many more people on the internet. You can find out, for whatever your concerns are other people in other states having similar concerns? Are there other people who are already trying some of the solutions that you're interested in? Are there other people who have support networks already? It may be that you can come to the folks, say, at Extension. You can come to them with, here are five ideas that other people are already using in these states, and they have similar circumstances that we have here, and now you kind of present a fully thought out, fully baked solution that makes it a lot easier for people to digest it, understand it, and then even agree with you.
Well, see, the problem I have is I understand all that.
Okay.
I understand. But the thing of it is, I'm talking about education, you know, like a continuing professional retraining, you know, like any other professional group. And I would think just that idea would make them want to sit up and say, okay, let's discuss this. Let's have a dialogue. What's your ideas? Let's meet. And let's talk more about it as an individual, as a farmer, you know, and as somebody that cares deeply about education for farmers. But yet, that, again, you know, nothing happens, you know, and I've done this for several years, probably the last 10 years. I've tried to, you know, have dialogue with different people, and I don't understand, you know, I understand the number part, but, you know, at least wouldn't we have a dialogue in a higher level with the university or with Extension?
Have you tried that, to go up the chain of command in the Extension?
Years. I've been doing it for 10 years. I've done it with, Like I said, I get a slap on the back and say, yeah, we look at that, and helped out the door.
One other suggestion that I might have is, if you've tried within the university system to move up the chain of command, then maybe that means you have to go outside the university system. Writing state senators and so on might be a good solution. State representatives, they might be people who can go ahead and apply that leverage and at least get you a hearing.
Well, now, I've even talked to high people in USDA, and everybody recognizes the fact that everybody understands that, yes, this would be a good program. Yes, this is something that we need to talk about. Yes, it's something that, you know, needs to happen. And everybody understands that.
Okay.
But yet nobody wants to take it to the next level.
Well, what's the but that they always have? If they say yes, what's the but that they have? It sounds like what you're saying is,
there's a but because there's no numbers, I guess. They don't think the market is there.
Okay.
And they don't view us, I feel, I don't get viewed as a professional person, as a farmer.
Well, there's your leverage right there. It's, if they don't believe that the numbers are there, what can you do to prove that they are? What can you do to demonstrate that your idea is actually going to work and be marketable?
It sounds like, you know, it's like everything else. It's a marketing problem. I mean, it's just like everything else. you know, you have to advertise. You have to take an idea and look at it and see if there's any demand out there. You know, I mean, I can't do it as myself, you know, because I would spend all my time doing that and not farming. But what I'm saying is education. You're talking about education, okay, something that should be interested, you know, to the people, you know, in a university or in an extension, and they should take it and look at it and say, education, that's our mission, that's our outreach, that's everything that we stand for. Let's look at it. Let's just take a look at it. You know, maybe it won't pan out. But yet they don't even, I feel that they don't even want to look at it.
Well, once again, I'd have to go back to try looking at other universities, other extensions, and other universities, and see if they've tried similar things. I hate to tell you this, but maybe here's the other perspective. If you've been trying for 10 years and nobody's been able to really hear you, it may be time to throw in a towel. It may be time to acknowledge that the idea is not quite as good as you think it is.
Well,
and that might be a way for you to just kind of move on to the next thing. And maybe,
well, I have. I mean, I've not near intense about it as I used to be.
Oh.
You know, it's just something that it disappoints me, because here you think of education, you know, and I'm a professional. I mean, is that a wrong thought, that farmers are professional people?
Of course not.
Absolutely not. And
well, why don't we recognize it? I don't understand that. See, again, I don't understand the logic is you're just a bunch of damn farmers. Well, you know, I'm just as a professional person as anybody, and I don't get that. I don't get that industry-wide almost. I mean, it's really amazing that that we're looked at as a bunch of individuals, and we really don't know what we're doing, and we're not treated as professional people, you know, a lot of the times. Okay, well, I've taken too much time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the call. Tom, let me follow up on this. Our last caller is a very interesting story. Sounds very articulate, like a very nice gentleman, and very intelligent.
Quite.
Have you run into cases where, I mean, I think we all have, I guess, there's resistance to new ideas, that within an organization, we've always done it this way, we do it this way, this is what we do, and you come along with an idea that you think will improve things, but, if, you know, it's almost like, you know, if your idea is so good, how come we didn't do it, you know, before? So therefore it can't be good. It's almost, you know, on the basis, well, since we're not, you know, since we're intelligent and we're not doing this, therefore it's not a good idea.
You know, I think most of the time it's just people like the status quo. It's the comfort zone. People at least know what, even if the situation they're in is not particularly positive, at least they understand it, mm-hmm. and they've learned how to cope with it. And that's, I think, the primary force that drives resistance to any change, whether that's a new program, a simple idea for a new project, or even just wanting to change the color of the walls.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time, I believe it's just status quo. The other thing that you always have to think about when you're proposing an idea for a change is who's going to win and who's going to lose, who will benefit and who is going to have to pay the price. And that's a question that we often don't ask when we're trying to implement change. Whether that change, again, is something as simple as I want to try to change a procedure I use in my job that really only affects one or two other people, if anyone, or whether that's making a big, giant organizational change. If you understand who's going to lose, then you can take steps to maybe minimize the loss for that person, or at least explain to them what's going to happen, so that other people don't feel like they're going to lose as well. I think right now you see it playing out in the national and international scenes. Iraqis are extremely frustrated, is probably a good word. Impatient is a good word. And I think the problem is that this change, this great change in their society, has been thrust upon them, and they're still going through the process, the change process. How long is it going to last? I think we can look at Russia for the answer to that. They're still reeling in the changes after communism fell and after their governments changed, and it's been 12, 15 years. Mm. I should expect we're going to see the same thing in Iraq. Why? Because they've got to learn totally new ways of interacting with each other, of dealing with each other, of creating their own rules and guidelines, of determining what's fair and what's not fair in their society. The same exact dynamics happen in organizations and even in families. When you have big changes, then people need time to kind of work through those changes. I was just reading something in the last couple days that says any major change you want to implement in an organization, for example, you can expect it to take 3 to 5 years to really take root. And people go through a very, very predictable set of reactions to change. First, there's denial. People pretend that they don't really need the change. Then there's the act of resistance where people fight the change. Eventually, people kind of get to that point where they decide, well, maybe I should look around for a way to deal with this change. So they search for solutions. And finally, they start implementing solutions and accepting the change. And maybe even if they're positive and constructive, they embrace the change. But that typically is going to take 3 to 5 years for a major organizational change. This is true in families as well. Families go through the same process when you have big changes, whether that's something as radical as a divorce or a new baby in the household or somebody leaving for college, or whether it's any of the little changes that go on over time. So we have to really take a look at this whole process of how people respond to change as a reality and as an important thing to work through. It's interesting in organizations, one of the big challenges is people at the top of organizations decide we need to change, and so we're going to do this part of our business differently. And they go through this process, but by the time they're ready to say, let's actually change and implement the change, now they just announce it to all the employees down the line. The employees are now just starting their change process. And leaders often get very frustrated, and they think, why aren't those employees changing? Why aren't they willing like us? Well, the fact is the leaders have had a long time to go through their change process. The employees are just the front end of that change process. They'll get there eventually, but not at the same time as the leaders. And that's where you have the biggest problems. So, you know, we go right back to communication. Mm-hmm. When we talk openly in organizations, in teams, and even in families about what changes are coming up, what these changes might mean for us, and how can we prepare for these changes, everybody is closer to being on the same page, and so we can go through that process more together. Leaders will still always have that little further sight, so they'll always be able to see changes more faster or earlier than employees, always, typically, I should say. But that's a process, if we have that open communication, where we'll have less of the fear that you had talked about before from Deming and more constructive reactions to change because we're going through it together.
We're well past our midpoint here. We have actually about 15 minutes left with Thomas Schenck. He's with the Schenck Development Group in Champaign. He's a consultant, educator, and career coach. We're talking about career issues and how to do better in the workplace. And we're taking your questions if you'd like to join us. Our lines are open. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you can hear us in the United States, 800-222-9455. One of the themes that has run throughout our conversation, Tom, is change, as we were just talking about. And it seems that, you know, perhaps this isn't entirely true, but it seems to be the case that more has changed in the workplace in the last 20 years than perhaps ever before, although I suppose previous epochs could, you know, you could point to the introduction of the steam engine and, you know, a variety of other, you know, electricity, for example. But now we have the internet and computers and instant communication globally and so many more ways for, change to happen in the organization. And yet we expect people to be agents of change while change is happening to them. And I guess I'm wondering about what your thoughts would be about how you manage that. How do you avoid sort of being buffeted about by the change and actually be, you know, someone who can effectively make choices in changing circumstances?
Well, first I want to acknowledge you're absolutely correct. We are actually having more change now. It's easy to think, oh, well, everybody has always said that there's too much change. But you can measure it in fact, that we're changing at a much faster rate than ever before. You mentioned so the electricity, the locomotive, the steam engine. Imagine all of those things coming in the same 2 or 3 year period. Mm-hmm. That would have radically changed society. That's what we face all the time. And one little experiment is think about some of the machines that were common, say, before 1985 that were not even that are now – let's see how I want to phrase this – machines that were not at all common or available at all before 1985 that are common today. And it's an amazing how many day-to-day machines, whether it's a PDA, whether it's CDs, whether it's a fax machine, certainly the desktop computer, laser printers. You know, these are just a couple of very simple examples.
Cell phones, email
of radical changes that are very, very recent. Most of us who are in the working world today remembers when these things were not there. And that's the kind of reality that we are facing. The speed of change, the rate of change is certainly increasing. The big question or the big skill that people need to develop is resilience or mental toughness. And there's a lot of things that we can look at for resiliency and mental toughness. One of them, believe it or not, focuses on what we've already been talking about. It's setting priorities, which go hand in hand with setting goals. People who have goals and priorities don't experience change as quite as turbulent. They feel more confidence in the idea that they're going to meet change as it comes to them because they've got a plan. Now, whenever you set a plan, of course, you have to realize that change will cause you to change the plan. But having the plan and then making changes is always less stressful than not having a plan and then just going wherever the wind blows you. So that's one of the big keys. Another key from what we've already talked about is relationships. The more you build up your support system, and that's both on the job and off the job, the more easily you'll be able to handle change when it comes up at work. So that support system includes having a positive or constructive relationship with the person you report to, a positive and constructive relationship with the people who you work directly with in your department, in your team, and in other teams as well. Trying to develop positive or constructive relationships with customers, for example. Those kind of positive or constructive relationships are the ones that are going to feel more satisfying. They're going to provide you with the resources and kind of emotional support that you need to get through changes. They also provide the opportunities to contribute to other people. And as many folks know, when we help other people, our own stress level goes down. When we do things that make other people's life more easy or more satisfying or more fulfilling, then that kind of comes back right toward us, and we feel better too. So we go right back to the importance of relationships.
Let me ask you, following up on that, are you suggesting that developing and maintaining a support system at work should be part of your top priorities and daily routine, as opposed to simply doing work, that one should work on relationships as an active day-to-day process?
Absolutely. And the reason is because there are very few jobs anymore where you're working on your own and you never have any interaction with other people. Most everyone works in a job where interaction with others is a common, frequent, and job-required kind of activity. So we need to be able to develop, and notice I keep saying positive or constructive relationships. Mm-hmm. You can be friendly and friends with all of your coworkers, bosses, etc. That's great. Not everybody's going to do that. And even if you're generally in that mindset, you won't be able to establish a friendship with every single person you come into. It's not practical, and sometimes the other people don't want to play. Mm-hmm. So it's not possible always. But we can at least establish a constructive relationship. And the constructive relationship means that we can get along well enough to do the job. And we can interact with each other in a way that is professional and that doesn't prevent either one of us from getting work done. You know, conflict that is unresolved gets in the way of productivity, and that's one problem. When we have the situation, and I've seen this in some workplaces, where somebody says, well, I'm just not going to talk to that person. And it takes a tremendous amount of effort and energy from those two people. They can't make their contribution to the work itself. There's a lot of research that shows that the average supervisor spends 25% to 35% of their time managing conflicts between their employees. I know a lot of supervisors that I've talked to said they wish they could get it down to 25% or 35%. So this idea that relationships are important on the job, it's not just soft skills. It's not just, oh, that would be nice. It's not Pollyannish thinking. That's a practical, tangible, important aspect of every person's job. It's to get along with other people.
Is it reasonable to expect that two people who do not like each other can still negotiate a relationship at work?
Yes, even if you don't like each other, because that's not the requirement. The requirement is not to like your coworkers. The requirement is to work well enough to get the job done. If you stay goal-focused, and whatever the goals of your particular team, whatever the goals of your job description are, if you stay goal-focused, then it makes it easier. There are rare occasions when the people don't like each other so much that you have to separate them. And that's unfortunately a leadership decision that does not happen very often. In one case, I saw it happen because it was intolerable and it got in the way. It was two employees who were from India, and they were constantly bickering, in conflict, and it was getting to the point where it was extremely distracting for everyone. And the leaders and the managers in his department couldn't understand what was going on. And eventually, after talking with these individuals, they found that they were from different parts of India. So it looked like, oh, they're both from India. They should get along great. They were from completely different culture backgrounds, and the two areas from India had been at war for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So they had to be separated because there was no overcoming that amount of cultural animosity. That was an example where the management, once they understood the true nature of the problem, made the right call. They didn't fire either one of them. They just simply reassigned one of them so they worked in another area. That was an organization that was big enough where you could do that. If it's a smaller organization or if that's just not an option, sometimes management does have to step in and make the tough call. I had an example, again, here at the university about a year ago. A team called me and said, Tom, we need you to come and do some attitude training. And I kind of worried about that, not really sure what attitude training means, to tell you the truth. So I asked them the questions. I said, well, what's going on? They said, well, we have a team, and one of the employees isn't really doing a very good job, and all the other members of the team have got this bad attitude. And I said, okay, well, tell me about the supervisor, the team leader. Why isn't the team leader working with the employee to get the employee to work up to standards like everyone else? And there was a long pause, and they finally said, well, Tom, it's complicated. Which I kind of hear a subtitle that says, please don't ask us hard questions. And then I asked, okay, let me leave that one aside. What about the manager of the team? Is the manager working with the team leader so the team leader can work with the employee so the employee can work up the standards? And again, long pause. Well, Tom, you just don't understand. And of course, that was, again, trying to get off the subject. Now, that was an example where the problem was not in the team. The problem was not in the one employee who wasn't working up to standards. It wasn't in the group of employees who had a bad attitude because of the one. It was a leadership function. The leadership at two levels were not doing their job. And that's a big challenge when employees don't get together. If the leader can't facilitate a more productive relationship, then one of the people has to go. And leaders often are not willing or able to do that. That's a real challenge for a lot of people.
We have another call to talk with.
Great.
And we just have about 6 minutes left, so let's include this person in our conversation. This is someone in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
I was wondering if you had any interest or had ever looked at what Phil Jackson of the Chicago Bulls had to say about teamwork and meditation.
No. What did he say?
Well, I guess he just got his basketball team to work better by having them do some Zen meditation. I'm surprised you hadn't heard about that. What's the name of the book? Is it? I'm getting it mixed up. I don't think it's Hoop Dreams, but maybe someone else knows. He's written a book.
Well, I'm going to have to look that up then.
Yeah, Michael Jordan was involved.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't remember the name of the book, but I'm sure you're right that is part of his approach. But I haven't read it.
Yes, that would fall into the category of sometimes you have to slow down to go faster. That, I think, is an important aspect. And what that probably was going on there, not having read the book, I'm going to make some guesses here.
Maybe it's called Sacred Hoops? Could that be it? I don't know.
Well, that's a title of a book. I don't know if it's Phil Jackson's, but
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to look that up, though.
Okay.
But what happens sometimes in situations there, they were probably doing a lot of things. First of all, they were doing just some good stress-reducing exercises. If that's all they got out of it, that would still be a benefit to performance. They probably were doing it together, so they were all having a shared experience that goes well beyond the job. You know, their job was basketball, but it's still just a job after a while. And that kind of took them to a whole nother place where they felt more comfortable with each other. It probably opened up a lot of communication. They probably heard some very good perspectives on how to manage their own emotional focus and orientation, and that probably helped their performance as well. So a lot of cool things going. Jack, you're looking that up right now?
Yeah, actually it is Sacred Hoops. You were right.
Sacred Hoops.
Sacred Hoops, Spiritual Lessons of a Hardwood Warrior by Phil Jackson. And he also wrote a book called More Than a Game, which more than the title, I know nothing. But there you go.
Well, thank you very much for that recommendation. I'm going to pick that one up.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Sorry to cut you off. Speaking of books, I stacked a bunch on the table here that I thought you might draw from, and we're not going to have time to do that. But I'm wondering if in the remaining 3 or 4 minutes, if you have some recommendations for people to get, sources of ideas, books, things that you find particularly useful that you've drawn from.
There are there are so many great books out there. Let me run a quick couple that I think really stand out. One that I really got a lot out of myself, and I think is great for a lot of people, especially with some of the challenges we've got now. It's called Think and Grow Rich, A Black Choice. It's by Dennis Kimbrough and Napoleon Hill. It's based on the classic Think and Grow Rich, which is sort of a misleading title. It's not just about getting money. It's growing rich as a human being, growing rich spiritually, emotionally, in every other way. But I really like this particular book from Kimbrough and Hill because it takes well-researched principles of self-management and success and focuses them specifically toward minorities. And they do tons of research over the last 150, almost 200 years in our own nation about how African Americans have been able to overcome odds and become tremendously successful in whatever they were doing. And anyone out there, whether you're black or not, if you feel like sometimes everyone's against you, if you feel like you never get an even break, you need to read the book because this book will show you your life is pretty darn good. And there are tremendous opportunities here if you follow some very simple basic principles. And this book explains them in a very powerful way. If nothing else, it's one of those books where you read it and you will feel great because there's so many good success stories out there. For everyone who fails, there's at least somebody else who succeeds. And that is certainly one of the strengths of our country, really. So that's a great one. Another one I'd recommend right off the bat is The Brand U 50 by Tom Peters. Peters has got a whole number of books out now that are really focusing on how you get through work today. The Brand U 50 is a great one on taking that notion that you need to become and embrace that idea of being a free agent. It's taking total control of your professional life. It's taking full responsibility for your professional life. And it's doing the kinds of things that are going to provide you as much employability security as is possible. Job security, of course, is dead, but employability security is the idea that if you develop a portfolio of skills and abilities and talents, no matter what happens in the organization you're in right now, you will have what a future employer would want to have. And quite frankly, in the organizations that most of us are in, you have to prove every day that you're worth keeping as an employee. And being able to continually prove that you're worth at least as much as they're paying you is a good thing. And The Brand U 50 is one of those books that really does that well. Those are a couple right off the bat. Let's see, what else that I've read recently really is an important one. Well, I mentioned The Bad Attitude Survival Guide, I think, previously. That's a great –
great title anyway.
Actually, that's the reason I got it at first. It's for the title. The Bad Attitude Survival Guide. Chambers is the author. And what it does is it really focuses on – it's for leaders, but everybody can use it. It's how do you deal with people who do have that bad attitude. And everybody works with at least one person like that. The funny thing is even bad attitude people don't like to hang around bad attitude people. And this book gives you some very constructive ways to manage those relationships and turn them even into positive relationships. So it's a great book, too. If you have a difficult person in your life at home or on the job, this is a book for you.
I'm really sorry to say that we're out of time here, and there's a caller who just joined us from Chicago that I must apologize to, that we ran out of time, and unfortunately we can't take you during this hour. But I'd like to continue this conversation, and in fact, maybe the next time we can pursue what we just started, which is talking about some of these books on career ideas and various aspects of work life, because I think that could be very interesting. I think we sort of said we were going to do that. Ended up in a slightly different direction, but still nonetheless, I think it was a useful conversation.
Well, just remember, when you're out buying your Harry Potter book, go ahead and swing by the business section and see if you could find something that'll be great for you and your work life.
Good. And maybe we'll talk about that next time then.
Thanks, Jack.
Everyone, thanks so much, Tom. Tom Schenck is a career consultant and educator with the Schenck Development Group here in Champaign, Urbana.